Well, great. Thank you very much. I think, if I can ask the panelists to take a seat and then we can open up to some general discussion. Is there a microphone here? Well, let's see if people can shout if they... please wave a hand if you can't hear anybody. We have a couple of questions which I've held over. And are there any specific... Is there one specific question to Steve? Yes, okay, well, yes, we have it. I'll introduce you.
Brian Keane, I wonder whether you ought to take a leaf out of the Humanitarian Centre's book and change your name. Because what you've been talking about, and having known, could say, the NSA from when it was first formed and been involved with it, you are now talking about safety, security, and sustainability. So, which I think is great. I think it's, and thank you for the way you've outlined it. But the thing that I found really missing from your presentation, this is why I wonder whether you need a name change, and you'd have to sort it out with the Department of Health. You don't mention anything about public health, and particularly the obesity issue. So one of the biggest issues that we face in terms of nutrition, food utilization, and so on, you seem to have skated over that and left it out completely.
I suppose largely it's an issue now that is within the remit of the Department of Health. I like your articulation of what a new name might be. That would be the FSSSA, which is maybe too much of a mouthful. So from the 6th FSA, maybe the Food Systems Agency. I suppose those of us who've been working in the field see obesity and overnutrition as just another facet of food safety, chronic rather than acute, about the gross effects of the diet rather than chemical or microbiological contamination. But it is safety. And when we talk at the beginning of that articulation of consumer interests about food being safe, and then later on people having access to food that's of an acceptable nutritional quality, when we think about the challenges that there might be in reconfiguring the whole of public procurement of food towards sustainable and secure diets, hopefully, if you don't see it in the headlines, you can see it in the actions we're proposing.
Yeah, but you're talking about bringing the public debate, and it seems to me you're ignoring the public debate as far as the issue of public health and obesity.
Well, I think it's impossible to ignore the debate. I think you only have to think back to the seminal work by Mike Rayner, again of about a decade ago, that said in the British population, about 37% of their ill health is related to the diet, and of that, only 0.2% is related to foodborne illness. The remainder, the vast majority of ill health in this country that's related to diet, is about not just obesity, but other dietary habits that lead to coronary heart disease, cardiovascular disease, cancers, other chronic risks. So I do apologise if what I know and believe and understand has led me to be too implicit in how I project it. It's certainly not at all. If we deliver a diet for people that is safe and sustainable, but leads to the burden of obesity and common heart disease than the carbon diet does, then you would have failed.
Thank you. I'd like to open it up and maybe take a couple of comments, or two or three comments, and then turn it to the panel. So, did you have your comment here at the back, and then we'll come.
So Luke Brayden of Plant Sciences. It was a question mainly for Jenna regarding getting businesses to work together on natural capital. So, I think you can imagine a lot of systems where exploiting natural capital in the short term can be more beneficial in the short term, but then destroy the resources in the long term. So in a competitive market system, what do you think the best way to encourage cooperation between these companies is, instead of having one of them outcompete the others and destroy the resource?
Thank you.
I have got two questions for Lara. The first first question is, what are the initiatives which are relevant to food security being done now in Cambridge? And the second question is, because I'm still a university student, I would like to know more about the volunteering opportunities that are provided here in Cambridge.
Great. They're excellent questions, which some of which may be better addressed in the, or sort of can maybe quickly addressed now and then followed up later. Yeah, let's have two more, and then return to the panel.
Yeah, I think actually my question was already partly asked. At the end, it was to Gemma Watson, but I wasn't quite clear at the end whether it was an appeal to big business to if only they could recognise the value of investing in natural capital. And my question was rather similar: was are you proposing an agenda, maybe through case studies, to demonstrate to them that actually it's commercially viable and they will be their competitors? Or are you saying, look, you know, you've got to figure it out for yourself? So I wasn't quite sure what the message was.
Yeah.
Actually, that was the question I had for Gemma as well, clarification on the value chain, because with the value chain analysis, there are so many ways you can use the comparative case studies. And at the same time, there is also another element within the natural capital discourse, the natural resource accounting process. A lot of the private sectors have acknowledged that, and it is actually more and more building up into their balance sheets, especially in P&L. And it didn't seem like you quite acknowledged the two separate indicators. One is a case study-based learning process, the other one is the application-based learning process, where you are introducing new methods of calculating the assets. So yeah, it would be great to know where this project is taking the private sector's interaction.
Okay, while we're on this, we're really putting Gemma on the spot. Are there other questions we put to Gemma? Then we'll just turn to Gemma and then we can... have you got them so far?
Yes.
Know, the competition and how the evidence is playing out. Yeah, two more to Gemma and then we'll turn to Gemma.
I have a quick question for Gemma. Nina Kudjakova, University of Oxford. While talking about natural capital, I wonder whether in your research you engage with the concept of stranded assets and whether you find it helpful.
Okay, and then Ivan, last question to Jim.
Unsurprisingly, it's about politics. But actually, it's for all of you. So I think all of you touched on this question of knowledge in one way or another. And I think all of you, in one way or another, presented the problem of food security or changing consumer behavior as largely one of knowledge deficit. So yes, Angela, you're talking about if only we could communicate to businesses just how important natural capital is, and of course they would change their practices. Again, if only we could communicate through labels to consumers what the impact of this was, carbon footprint, and then consumers would change their behavior. I'd like to throw a spanner in that works and put a challenge to you, that actually, empirically, there's quite a lot of research, both on the producer side and consumer side, that, A, as we've shown by the talks this morning, these are massively complex systems and chains. And I found out today that my cornflakes come from Argentina. I didn't know that, and I spend a lot of my time thinking about what I eat in food security professionally. So actually, are we kidding ourselves, really, that A, we can communicate these things in a way, in a meaningful way, especially once we start to offset carbon versus biodiversity, which one do we choose? Can we make a meaningful choice? And B, also, are we kidding ourselves that even if we were to make this clear, is this really a knowledge deficit problem? And the evidence coming from carbon trading, for example, is yes, we know climate change is happening. Yes, we can put a value on the carbon in forest. Yes, we can probably quantify the amount of carbon in forest, but are we willing to pay the price? No, we're not. So actually, the big problem there is not one of knowledge deficit, it's one of politics and being willing to bear the burden. So there you go, kind of gets slightly banty at the end there, but
good.
That's my kind of statement.
Okay, I'm going to turn to the panel now. I can see there are other people wanting to come in. But Gemma, maybe first on some of these kind of technical, well, quasi-technical questions about how your platform is working, and then maybe we'll open up to the panel to respond to Ivan about the politics. Are we really talking about a knowledge deficit?
Perfect. Well, thank you very much for all your questions, and it's lovely to feel so popular and such a lot of interest from everybody. And if do grab me at coffee as well, if there are any others who've been shy in coming forward. Gosh, how do I deal with all of these? So the short-termism, I think, is a really important question. It's something that's not just an issue for business, it's also for policy as well, in getting those quick wins. And the outcome, sort of the competitive out-competing each other thing is, I would love to be able to say, yes, we've got the perfect answer of how to do that. And I think in terms of sort of competitiveness 2.0, we need to just try, again, we've come around with new labels and stuff, we need to just try and shift the models of what success actually looks like. And if we can demonstrate, you know, at some point there's going to be a crunch, that your short-termism and your short-term thinking is going to cause you to fail because you completely degraded the soil that you need to grow your corn in Argentina for your Kellogg's cornflakes. That's going to happen at some point in the next 3, 5, 10 years. So yes, it's a long-term projection, but the actual period when it's going to happen is going to be a massive crunch. So I think we need to start getting companies to start recognising it's in their own interest in the long term, but if they don't fix it first themselves, their competitors are going to fix it for them and they're going to come and swoop in. So I don't know if that fully answers your question, but...
I would just say 2008 might be a good example of a big crunch that was caused by short-termism.
Yeah.
And we're still...
dealing with it now.
But yeah, and we haven't changed it, right?
Absolutely. So the next question was on, was I appealing to companies to do something, or was I asking for some kind of demonstration of evidence? And I think it's a little bit of both, really. So now, what I've been quite frustrated with is all these fabulous commitments from companies. They've all got these, you know, our top three strategic priorities. And I applaud them for doing that. But I can't necessarily see any action that's demonstrable, that's on a scale, that's actually going to help them achieve any one of those targets.
But can you get them to fund you in your organisation to de-out some examples?
So that's exactly what we're trying to do. So this Align project is essentially, it's an ask of major corporations to come and work with us and with each other to actually say, hang on a second, we recognise this long-term issue that keeps on cropping up. We've made promises to deliver to shareholders, stakeholders, customers. We actually now need to collectively show that we can take some change, we can start to invest into something, and they've got then the evidence that demonstrates, yes, that is possible, yes, we can use that.
Because the paradox always is that, in fact, these big companies have incredibly long-term strategic visions. They're always working on them. But they won't mainstream anything until they're absolutely convinced that it's going to give them a competitive advantage.
Absolutely. And I think we need to push them on that. And we need, there's little pockets out there of great examples, but we just need a much bigger, many more examples, and ones that are scalable as well. Stranded assets, no, is probably the quick answer to that. It's essentially, let's think of an example. So if you were create a, from an agricultural perspective, you make a huge investment in a new crop, and company puts lots of money down towards that. Suddenly, the climate's starting to shift, and actually there's no water that's available for you to irrigate that crop. That's now an asset that you can't access, and you can't get any capital back out of it. I hope I've said that right.
And there's one more thing.
Policy.
No, there's a... Was your question answered? No.
Yeah.
No.
Mine.
Yes.
Yes. Yeah,
it was EP&L and natural capital assessment.
It was more on the tool that you would be... Because there are many ways companies are integrating those natural capital resource measurement into their, like, the shadow pricing and the natural accounting. So... wondering to what extent you are actually going to utilize that, or is it part of your toolkit that you're going to put out for those who are falling behind?
Absolutely. So I should probably plug one quick thing, very quickly.
One quick plug.
Which is the Natural Capital Protocol, which is essentially a framework run by the Natural Capital Coalition that's looking at natural capital assessments from impacts and dependencies all the way through to measuring and valuing it. And we would exactly be looking to build on that. They're using some of our methodologies that we've developed over the years as well.
Great. Now I propose to ask other Lynn, Lara and Steve if they want to briefly touch on aspects of Ivan's question, and then we'll turn back to the floor, if you like, and see if you want to comment on some of the questions that the panellists posed, which is effectively in various ways, if the research would start from the consumer's perspective, the farmer's perspective, the poorest of the poor's perspective, would that change the nature of the research, particularly in a large interdisciplinary research practice? What are the challenges and opportunities of working between sectors? And what kind of barriers or what are you doing at the moment? And really, that set of questions that came from panelists. Okay, so first, maybe Lynn, Lara and Steve on Ivan's question, and then open this line of questioning for the last 5 or so minutes.
Can I, before I move on to Ivan's question, which is an excellent question, can I come back to something which Gemma said? And I would say over the few years that I've been working with a whole set of companies, retailers and food manufacturing companies and growers on sustainability generally, I've been quite surprised by how prominently they place biodiversity as one of their sustainability priorities. I wouldn't have expected them to, because I don't think it's so easy to make the natural capital argument that Gemma makes for biodiversity. And when challenged, and I've worked particularly with Sainsbury's growers and Waitrose growers on this, they usually say it's a reputational thing. We love biodiversity, everyone loves wildlife, we love farmed birds, we care about it, consumers care about it, we don't want to be seen to be damaging it, and there's a value in that for us. And I think we shouldn't lose sight of that. That's important. We need to grasp the fact that biodiversity is valuable to society and consumers, and make the most of that as a driver. So just wanted to say that. On the knowledge deficit question, I think there is a huge knowledge deficit. From every angle that you look at it, it cuts both ways and all ways. So there's a knowledge deficit in that scientists don't understand the science that's gone before them. Businesses don't understand the science. They also don't understand the knowledge base of their own suppliers. So as examples of that, you know, I've had discussions with grower and supplier groups within the Waitrose Economy Group about how surprised they've been by the particular practices that are being demonstrated and the evidence that's being compiled on farms in South America, for example, about how to manage pests without chemicals. It's out there, and it's not documented, it's just going on. On the Kellogg's and Argentinian corn example, through the use of the Cool Farm tool, it became apparent that the soil management in Argentina means there's much higher soil carbon storage, and it's actually more sustainable in many ways to have corn in Argentina than in Spain, because of the soil type, the tillage processes that go on, and the water supply, which again was learning from, you know, the knowledge is there in the Argentinian farmers. They've been managing soil like that for a long time now, but the large scale food supply chain didn't realise that until we started to look. So I think although there's obviously other questions about motivation, that there are huge knowledge deficits wherever we go, and a big sustainability challenge for me is just sharing information.
I think knowledge inequality and knowledge deficits is political. The fact that it exists is political, was generated by politics, and I think needs to have a political response. But it's not just politics and science. We need to think about economics, culture. Whenever one tries to do an intervention, you hit all these different blocks. And so what we try to do is bring together people who bring those different perspectives. So you do have politicians talking with economists or talking over each other, but at least they're not in the same room. But yes, I think if you don't acknowledge that it is political at base, the fact that we have a problem, then we're not going to be able to generate any.
In terms of engaging and communication with consumers, I probably agree. That's not to say that consumer information about products is worthless, but I don't think it's certainly not the place you should start. So, which is why I was keen to set out almost a process of things we need to do, which is about, first of all, engaging everyone in the debate, secondly, mobilising and coalescing some demand for products that better balance safety, sustainability and security, and only then will information products have any resonance and be able to be used by consumers.
Thank you. I mean, given that my primary aim is to keep time, what I propose to do is instead of take questions which we put back to the panel, do people want to make a few final comments from the floor, and then you can catch up with the panel over tea? So are there, I can see one, two, three, four, and a half. Okay, let's take four comments, and if we have time, a half a comment. Yes. That's a question which we're going to have to take as a comment, because time. Yes.
Charles May. The behaviour of we individuals in small organisations and large organisations is very much affected by legislation. And I'd be interested in hearing our chairman's comments on what progress is being made at persuading the politicians to go for evidence-based policy making.
That's another good question, which you might be interested to have to take as a comment for now. Did you want to have a brief?
Yeah, I mean, just to raise this question of trade-offs, really. And I tell you, I agree with you that there are more things we can always do to improve knowledge of everyone, including ourselves. But I guess, and building on Jim's presentation as well, I guess what I have a problem with is this idea that there's this magic win-win to be had. Either through more knowledge or more technology, or magically factoring the value of nature into the practices of contemporary capitalism. Point is, and I think you were the only person to bring this issue of trade-offs explicitly, and I thank you for it, because I think ultimately it's a question of trade-offs, and I think we have to make those explicit, and then we have to make sure that they're negotiated and contested. And that's why I mean about politics. I think to pretend otherwise is to try and wish it away.
Thank you. We're out of time. Do you have a very quick half hour?
I'll have a chat.
Okay, so with that slightly unusual end, which is a bunch of sort of concluding questions and comments from the audience, which I think were very interesting in terms of, you know, how can researchers improve their listening skills and in relation to some of these difficult dilemmas that have been with us for a long time, but allied to the point that it doesn't require necessarily reinventing wheels. There are mechanisms and opportunities to do it, and I think that the kind of partnerships and tools and approaches that our four panelists have demonstrated show that actually you know, there are opportunities really right here for us to work in this way. I mean, the two final comments were tough ones, and in some sense, evidence, policy, decision making, trade-offs, the power and politics of these things—they're irreducibly complex, and which makes it, quite intellectually interesting as well as important that we engage with that. That's my cop out for now. But just, I think you'll join me in thanking our four panelists very much for their stimulating presentations and answers.